Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Can you hear me on the phone?
I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not, you're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I've forgotten.
I have too.
I'm talking today to Helen Pluckrose, author of a number of published academic works, arguing that, among other things, dog parks have a problematic rape culture and that men can mitigate their transphobia by anally penetrating themselves with dildos. If that makes her sound like a lunatic caricature of right-on wokeness, it's supposed to. She wrote those so-called papers as part of an elaborate hoax to expose shoddy scholarship in academical fields focused on gender, race, and other hot-button issues. Now she's co-authored the book, Cynical Theories, which is essentially a history of the ideas of critical theory, or what most people will know as wokeness. Spoiler alert, she is not a fan. When did you become such an unreconstructed bigot, Helen?
Probably from birth, I expect. But I became aware of it when I went back to university at 34 and started studying English literature and came across all of this postmodern theory and the derivations of it, post-colonial theory and queer theory and all the rest of it, and trying to do scholarship through those lenses was, that was what made me not a fan.
Have you had a lot of hate mail since this book came out?
Yes, I also have several committed stalkers. Few physical threats, but a lot of nastiness, and I've had to block people on several sites. And it's what you expect, really, when you address sensitive issues.
I mentioned your hoax or hoaxes in the intro. It's become known as the grievance studies affair. You and your co-conspirators wrote 20 academic papers. That is quite a lot of trouble to go to. Was it really worth it?
I think it was. We wanted to get right into the system. I mean, we call it a hoax, and there are certainly hoaxish elements to it, but mostly we wanted to get into the system. We wanted to see how it would work, see what we could get them to accept or not, see how the reviewers would direct us. Now, this gives me grounds, because people are constantly telling me I don't agree with these theories because I don't understand them. I need to read more. So I thought, if I can get published critical race and feminist philosophy in Hypatia, the home of those kind of theorists, people will have to accept I know what I'm talking about and will understand it. We can be sure we know what we're talking about, and we're not, you know, just picking off a few stray lunatics that are sort of sneaking in by mistake.
Well, let's talk about your book. It's quite grown up. Personally, I find much of this stuff unintelligible. Maybe you could describe what it is and why you've written about it in accessible terms.
Okay, so it's rooted in postmodern theory mostly in terms of knowledge, power, and language. So these are ideas that came primarily from Foucault. He's definitely the strongest voice in all of this. And it's the idea that knowledge, Michel Foucault, the French philosopher.
Oh, that Frenchman, yes.
Yeah. And he said that power and knowledge were so intertwined that they should be called the same thing. And he called it power knowledge. Everything that we think of is true has actually been constructed by powerful forces in society. Then once they've legitimated knowledge, and we're going for Jean-François Lyotard now with the legitimation of knowledge part, then this is spread through society. So our society, for example, regards science very highly as a producer of knowledge. Therefore, if we are told that it is scientifically proven that something is true, as far as science ever claims to have proved anything, then we accept that this is true. Now, this, according to the postmodernists, is a cultural construct, that we are in favour of science and reason because this is how the West has developed. Then the later theorists took this on to say, this is how the West has been developed by straight white Western men. And so they've broken into a lot of identity and cultural theories to look at different ways of knowing and structures of power that apparently most of us can't see. The systems of power like white supremacy, patriarchy, cis-normativity, the assumption that everybody identifies as the sex that their genitals indicate, ableism, fat phobia. We can't see them, we normal people. We need these critical theorists to point them out to us and help us dismantle it all.
You must have read or tried to read a phenomenal amount of this stuff in critical theory. Were you ever concerned it might persuade you?
I actually do have to kind of wash my brain in between. I read, for one of the papers, I read six of the most sort of popular critical race books in 2 days. And I then tried to relax by watching a police, a sort of 1 hour police drama thing. And a mixed race student was graduating and she was hugging her parents. And I thought, she still loves her mother, even though her mother's white. And this oppressive force of whiteness must have affected her entire childhood. And this stuff gets into your brain and it really worries me. I'm probably more inoculated against it than the vast majority of people in it, but it really worries me about how young people, particularly young mixed race people, who are learning this sort of less critically, with less sort of understanding of the problems with it, how much it can affect them.
I think there's a generational element in all of this. I mean, I never had to study any of this bollocks at university, and I'm sorry for the sexist terminology, but my producer, who is 38, did have to study critical theory, and I'm interested as to where it came from.
Okay, so in the 60s and 70s, you would probably not have come across it unless you had been in France and in a particular theory, in particular sort of disciplines. So we have Michel Foucault, who's essentially a historian, and then Jacques Derrida, who is a linguist, and Jean-François Lyotard, who's a philosopher. So these ideas all sort of appeared in the middle of the 60s, right through to the middle of the 80s, prolific amounts of writing, this skepticism towards meta-narratives, big stories that we think are of as true. So Christianity could be a meta-narrative. Marxism is a meta-narrative. The original postmodernists were critical of Marxism for being an overly simplistic, totalizing explanation, but also science and progress. So if you'd have been in France and studying these kind of things then, you would have known about this, but most people didn't because it's really largely incomprehensible. If it had stayed in that form, honestly, I think of it as a virus, because it just deconstructed everything. It deconstructed itself by the middle of the 80s, and it could have died out. But the next wave of theorists, they are the ones who made it accessible and applicable, and they did that mostly by taking it to America. The French are generally very keen to distance themselves from responsibility for Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and Jean-François Lyotard. Postmodernism did not really continue into social justice in France in the same way as it has in America and here and Canada, Australia, the Anglosphere, although it is seeping into all over Europe. I'm hearing particularly from the Dutch and Swedes about it at the moment. So it's, you would probably, in the 90s, you'd probably have heard a little, if you'd been at university then, some of the original postmodernists. You might have had some post-colonial theory. Now, I went back to university late, so really only just over a decade ago. By this time, we have queer theory, which is really developed. And this is a very typically postmodern idea where you have to break down all categories. All categories have been constructed in the service of oppressive power. So there is no such thing as a man and a woman, masculine and feminine, gay and straight. These are all constructs, and we need to mix them all up. So queer becomes a verb. And to queer something is to take it out of its usual categories and mess around with it. So you get a lot of this queer theory now in feminism. You also get a lot of critical race theory in feminism, in the form of intersectionality. So critical race theory started off quite well. Its roots, its roots you can trace back to Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, and you know, freed slaves who argued for treating black people as human beings and for freedom of speech and things like this. And but as we've gone into the critical turn in the 70s, 80s, 90s, then we've got this really pessimistic approach. So I mean, critical in this sense, you know, it sort of comes from the Marxist sense, where Marx said the thing to do is criticise all of the things that exist. So we've got this critical turn at around this time, and anybody at university in this century is likely to have come across queer theory and critical race theory and intersectionality. Intersectionality is an unholy mixture of the kind of radical separatist politics that was happening from the New Left, the Black Panthers, Malcolm X, with postmodern theory, and an explicit rejection of liberalism and embrace of identity politics. It was bound to go wrong. It was bound to be a problem.
But critical theory, as you describe it there, is a pretty niche occupation, isn't it? Aren't you getting your knickers in a twist over nothing?
No. So critical theories, once they stayed in universities, that's fine. And I mean, I think for some, just to forestall some of your better read listeners, I'm not talking about the Frankfurt School. When we're talking about critical theories, talking much more broadly than critical theory as named by the Frankfurt School. Otherwise, you will get 100 people writing in and saying, no, she clearly doesn't know what the critical theory is and it's all about Habermas. No, it isn't. So anyway, where were we? My knickers are untwisted. The problem that we've had, when we published the book, we could see the problem seeping into so many different institutions. We finished writing it over a year ago, and we didn't predict what would have happened by now. So after the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests, we have received so many appeals for help from people whose employer, university or children's school is seeking to train them in dismantling their whiteness. They want affirmations of adherence to very specific concepts of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which aren't really how they're used in general terminology. They want people to affirm the existence of these invisible systems of power, particularly white supremacy, patriarchy, and cis normativity, and they want them to commit to dismantling them. And we're trying to push back at this. In the end, I've had to set up a Discord server to try to triage it so we can help the most urgent cases, people in immediate danger of being fired for not believing or pretending to be, say, racist. There's just so much of it. We're getting dozens of emails a day, people sending in new policies, new programs, training programs, and I am not a hyperbolic person. I generally am accused by my American colleagues of the problem of British understatement, but I don't think it's an overstatement to say that we are looking, particularly in the US, at a genuine attempted cultural revolution. There is an attempt to take over with these ideas of power and privilege, and I don't think it can win in the long term, but I think it can do a lot of damage before it gets pushed back.
So this is the point at which the BBC takes it as read that white privilege is a fact of life.
Yeah, that can be a symptom of it. When, you know, there are good scholars out there, who will look at this in a more nuanced way. In some areas of life, it probably is a privilege to be white. In more areas of life than it is to be a privilege to be black. For example, we only see people pretending to be black in very narrow spheres. So there's been a very few cases of people pretending to, white people pretending to be black or have black ancestry in order to attain some kind of privilege. I don't think it's untrue to say that white privilege quite possibly does still exist, but we need to measure this and we need to look at it empirically. We cannot theorize it into every situation.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How do you get from a bunch of second-rate French poseurs to wokeism infecting everything?
That development, I think it went in three stages. When the theorists in the late 80s and early 90s started writing particularly about gender, race, sexuality, disability and weight, then this became usable by activists. The language became clearer. There were more things to do with it. You could apply it to more things. So it became more popular and dominant in the humanities and various kinds of cultural studies. And then, of course, people leave universities, they go into all kinds of professions. But since 2010, it's really solidified and it's become a meta-narrative of its own. I mean, the original postmodernists would be spinning in their graves at this point, because we are told by people like Robin DiAngelo, whose book has sold out numerous times, White Fragility. She's the leading authority on this whiteness, white privilege, white fragility nonsense, harmful. Her language is so clear. She is so certain. She is telling us it is a fact that we all think like this. If you are a white person who was born in a predominantly white culture, you will think exactly the way she thinks about black people, and you'll either admit it and work to dismantle it, or you'll deny it and you'll be fragile and you'll perpetuate the problem.
We had a few questions on University Challenge the other day on a feminist post-colonialist deconstructionist called Spivak. Yeah. It's complicated stuff. Can you describe some of the other things that are happening today and tracing their intellectual origins?
Yeah, so let's have a go at Spivak then. So she traces herself back very clearly to Derrida. So she was radically sceptical of the power of language. So that's partly why she's so difficult to read. But it also means that she thinks that people who have been subordinated, the subaltern, the underclass, the colonized peoples, are unable to speak for themselves because they get the language of the oppressor imposed upon them. Now, that idea is what we see in the decolonized effort a lot more today. So when we see people wanting to tear down statues, rename buildings, decolonize the curriculum, and going to ludicrous extents like saying that maths and literacy and politeness and being on time are white characteristics. It's a significant problem. I myself managed to get myself invited to a symposium called Decolonize STEM, in which I intended to use a very good scholar, Mira Nanda, to argue that claiming that STEM belongs to straight white men, well, white men, is actually sexist and racist. But I wrote my pitch in the language, and they clearly didn't understand it and invited me. Then somebody Googled me, and I was informed that I can't go and argue that that claiming science to be a white male thing is racist and sexist because it endangers the safety of the other attendees. This is the belief in the power of language to be really destructive is overwhelming.
We've got far too many universities, haven't we, of people wasting their time with this sort of thing.
The thing is, I'm a defender of the humanities, and this is my overwhelming drive here, is I want to be able to do scholarship properly. I want to look at how late medieval women lived. That's what I want to do, and I don't want to have to do it through feminist, queer or post-colonial theory. I want to, you know, be able to study things rigorously again. And there's a lot of value. There's even value in teaching about culture and gender and identity. My next book is going to be on how we could do gender studies properly to be actually genuinely useful to society rather than a sort of paranoid conspiracy theory.
Before we get on to gender studies, are you saying systemic racism is a myth or what?
I think there is probably institutional racism in various places and time. I am convinced. I find scholars like Michelle Alexander, and here we're looking at the US, of course, and she gives an empirical look with a lot of data at police interactions with black communities. And I think she's made her case that there is a problem there. So I think systemic racism probably does exist. I don't believe it exists in the way the current theorists do, because they see it as working through language and through people and biases and attitudes. They see systemic racism and the system as all interactions. I don't believe that. I believe that individuals can choose to reject racist ideas. I believe that they can grow up not having been socialized into racist ideas in the first place. I don't believe the world is as simplistic as people like Robin DiAngelo insist it is.
It strikes me that this can also be seen as a history of the post-war left. Is that fair? I mean, previously, the sort of area you're talking about was infatuated with Marxism as its grand overarching narrative, but it seems to have replaced that with critical theory. And in so doing, they've abandoned class consciousness and replaced it with privilege consciousness, which is likely to push working class people towards the right, isn't it, if anything?
Yeah, I have argued this a lot, and so have a lot of other people, including Marxists. Of course, the traditional Marxists have been the longest standing critics of the postmodernists. If you think Chomsky arguing with Foucault, Habermas arguing against saying that postmodernism has a self-referentiality problem. If nothing is true, how can it be true? That nothing is true, you know. So, yeah, it's got this long history of wars on the left, and I think that we could see the emergence of postmodernism as a kind of radical disillusionment with Marxism, because that was the main framework on the left, and then it catastrophic manifestations of it occurred. I think among leftist intellectuals there was a sense of, well, now how can we trust anything? How can we believe anything is true? And this led to the whole idea that we need to deconstruct everything. So yeah, I think the left has shifted. It's worse in America because they had the Red Scare. They didn't have a consistently economic left that could exist openly. We've had Marxists and socialists parties. They've dwindled, but they still exist. And they have kept an economic left alive. So I myself would consider myself a liberal leftist with sympathies with Marxist criticisms of capitalism, with a realistic idea of acceptance that actually Marxism doesn't work. So we have this thing on the left where we've got an economic left, we've got a radical left, we've got a liberal left, we've got a social justice left. We have people who sort of pick and choose from various parts of them. But I think it's absolutely true to say that the working class has got largely pushed out of this. Some recent studies I was looking at in attitudes towards the police, for example, found that working class black Brits are more likely to feel positively towards the police. The biggest indication of negative attitudes towards the police was whether or not one had gone to university. Now, so there's a big, big class issue going on here, and this is why the Marxists accuse the social justice scholars and activists of essentially having stolen the left from the working class, taken it into the ivory tower, and they call it a sort of bourgeois hypocrisy, really, where you end up with arguments about whether black CEOs are getting paid the same as white CEOs, and nobody is caring at all about the working classes and the divisions between the working classes that can be made by trying to subdivide people by race, particularly gender. It's the feminism is actually waning now. We're seeing less of the gender wars that were so dominant only about 5 years ago, but much more of the fights over between the gender critical feminists and the trans activists.
This is totally unintelligible to anyone outside tertiary education, isn't it?
This is what I find, and this is what worries me so much, because I see people who want to argue with it, and they're saying, but this is contradictory, but this is inconsistent, but this is unjust. And I'm trying to explain how the thinking works, and it's really counterintuitive. So, I mean, cynical theories is an attempt to help people get their heads around it, because it took me several years of reading postmodernists and then applied postmodernists and then the recent sort of flood of popular and accessible books on race and gender to have to see these patterns. And I want people to understand them, and I want them to feel confident to push back at them saying, this is unethical, this is irrational, and it's unethical. You do not have a monopoly on racial, sexual, and LGBT equality. You have a method, and it's crap.
But if you're going to be cancelled in the cancelled culture that has arisen out of this, it takes a lot of guts to dissent, doesn't it?
It does. That's what we're trying to address most at the moment. I fortunately am uncancellable because I'm self-employed, and I can just log out of social media if I want to avoid the abuse. But this isn't the case for a lot of people. We get letters from people who are saying, I want to push back at this, but I need to keep my job. I have a family. And I find often that men express more concerns for their job. Women express more concerns about being believed to be racist or sexist. So I think there's a gender difference there, although both are concerned about both. So what we are doing at the moment, and it has come together organically, really quite quickly, is connecting people with each other. Because quite often someone will come to me and say, I work for this company and I think I'm the only person who sees a problem. And I can say, actually, no. Would you like me to introduce you to a couple of others? And by connecting people in this way, people in the same professions, people in the same organisations, and getting them to build their own sort of counter-organisations. We have them in psychology, social work, teaching. Now, psychologists are particularly concerned. There's concerns in medical fields. People getting together to embolden each other to push back at it. And I'm also, we have templates. We can sort of help them to argue with these ideas as safely as possible. If you come from a place of knowledge and a place of principles, it's quite difficult for them to misrepresent what you're saying. You need to show that you understand what you're criticising and that you're not opposing racial or gender equality. It also helps a lot if, while saying this, you're not a white man.
Yes. It's quite something when you have to almost develop subversive strategies to undermine something that is so nonsensical.
We're not blind to the fact that we are deconstructing the deconstructionists. We are trying to subvert the systems of power that that we see existing. And essentially what we're trying to do is form activist groups to speak truth to power. And, you know, this is... I find this amusing, because we're still hearing from the social justice scholars and activists that they are the radical minority who are pushing back against the orthodoxy, which is apparently the attitudes of the least enlightened people in the 1950s, when in fact they are the orthodoxy. They are a very dominant discourse in society, and they need deconstructing.
Well, you're welcome to your work, and I wish you luck with it. I'm glad I have to have nothing to do with critical theory, but thank you very much for joining us. Thanks a lot.
It was good talking to you.
Well, there you are. Helen Pluckrose, fighting the good fight against the excesses of critical theory. Apologies to those of you who are expecting David Omond, who I promise is coming very soon, probably just lurking by the lamppost somewhere. In the meantime, next week we've got another interview very much in keeping with the times. Dr. Rachel Clark is a former media type turned doctor specialising in palliative care. She spent the last year caring for some of the sickest patients of the pandemic, and she has plenty to say about it. Do join us for that, and in the meantime, keep washing your hands.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.